Did he make it to the tree too?
He made it to the temple of Bel Shamharoth.
Rincewind choked on his wine. His ears tried to crawl into his head in terror of the syllables they had just heard. The Soul Eater. The Soul Eater. His number lieth between 7 and 9. It is 2×4, Rincewind quoted, his mind frozen with fear. Oh, no. Where's the temple?
Upwards, towards the centre of the forest.
The dryad stood up and stretched out her hand.
Come, I am Drueli. Come with me and watch your friend's fate.
A staircase, broad as a major highway, wound up through the tree, with vast rooms leading off at every landing. Sourceless yellow light was everywhere. We were really in a tree? Rincewind asked.
We are? Drueli laughed. I can see into your mind, false wizard. Am I not a dryad? Do you not know that what you belittle by the name tree is but the mere four-dimensional analogue of a whole multi-dimensional universe which... No, I can see you do not. I should have realized that you weren't a real wizard.
Something made Rincewind turn around. There were 3 he-dryads behind him. They were as naked as the woman and unarmed. That last fact was irrelevant, however. They looked at him with wooden menace. Their skins were the colour of walnut husks, and under it, muscles bulged like sacks of melons. He turned around again and grinned weakly at Drueli. I'm not rescued, am I? I'm captured, right?
Of course.
And you're not letting me go? Drueli shook her head.
You hurt the tree. But you are lucky. Your friend is going to meet Bel Shamharoth. You will only die.
From behind, 2 hands gripped his shoulders in much the same way that an old tree root coils relentlessly around a pebble. There was a vast empty space like a hall, its roof lost in the golden haze. The endless stair ran right through it. Several 100 dryads parted respectfully when Drueli approached and stared through Rincewind as he was propelled firmly along behind.
Oh, incompetent wizard, said Drueli. See some magic. Not your weasel-faced tame magic, but root and branch magic. The old magic. Wild magic. Watch.
50 or so of the females formed a tight cluster, joined hands, and walked backwards until they formed the circumference of a large circle. The rest of the dryads began a low chant. Then, at a nod from Drueli, the circle began to spin widdershins. As the pace began to quicken and the complicated threads of the chant began to rise, Rincewind felt the familiar, sticky prickling in the scalp that indicated the build-up of a heavy charge of raw enchantment in the vicinity. And so he was not utterly amazed when a few seconds later a shaft of vivid octarine light speared down from the invisible ceiling and focused, crackling, in the centre of the circle. There it formed an image of a storm-swept, tree-girt hill with a temple on its crest. Rain streamed off the black walls of the temple. The only sign of life was the horse tethered outside. It wasn't Twoflower's horse. It was a white charger with hooves the size of meat dishes and leather harness aglitter with ostentatious gold ornamentation. It was currently enjoying a nose bag.
The sender of 8 has 2 for dinner, it seems, said Drueli.
She waved a hand. The focus of the image moved inwards, darted through a great octagonal archway, and sped along the corridor within. There was a figure there, sidling along stealthily with its back against one wall. There was no mistaking that shape. He'd seen it many times. The wide chest, the neck like a tree trunk, surprisingly small head under its wild thatch of black hair, looking like a tomato on a coffin. He could put a name to the creeping figure, and that name was Harun the Barbarian. Harun was one of the Circle C's more durable heroes, a fighter of dragons, a despoiler of temples, a hired sword, the kingpost of every street brawl. He could even, unlike many heroes of Rincewind's acquaintance, speak words of more than two syllables, given time and maybe a hint or two. There was a sound on the edge of Rincewind's hearing. It sounded like several skulls bouncing down the steps of some distant dungeon.
"Who is that, false wizard?" said Drueli, pointing at the Hrun image.
"I am a real wizard," snarled Rincewind. He stamped a foot petulantly.
"Indeed?" said the dryad. "Then let us see you pass a spell."
Began Rincewind. The fact was that since the ancient and mysterious spell had squatted in his mind, he'd been unable to remember even the simplest cantrap for, say, killing cockroaches or scratching the small of his back without using his hands. It was perhaps untrue to say that he'd learnt the spell. It had learnt him. The episode had led to his expulsion from Unseen University, because, for a bet, he had dared to open the pages of the last remaining copy of the Creator's own grimoire, the Octavo. The spell had leapt out of the page and instantly burrowed deeply into his mind, from whence even the combined talents of the Faculty of Medicine had been unable to coax it. Precisely which one it was, they were also unable to ascertain, except that it was one of the eight basic spells that were intricately interwoven with the very fabric of time and space itself. Since then, it had been showing a worrying tendency, when Rincewind was feeling run down or especially threatened, to try and get itself said.
"A small one would do," said Drueli, watching him curl his lips in a frenzy of anger and embarrassment.
The spell chose that moment to vault into the temporarily abandoned saddle of Rincewind's consciousness.
"I do know a spell," he said wearily. "Yes, pray tell," said Drueli.
Rincewind wasn't sure that he dared, although the spell was trying to take control of his tongue.
"You said you could read my mind," he said. "Read it!"
She stepped forward, looking mockingly into his eyes. Her smile froze. Her hands raised protectively, she crouched back. From her throat came a sound of pure terror. Rincewind looked around. The rest of the dryads were also backing away. What had he done? Something terrible, apparently. There was a brilliant flash. There was a sudden darkness. There was a vaguely Rincewind-shaped violet shadow, dwindling to a point and winking out. There was nothing at all. Hrun the Barbarian crept soundlessly along the corridors, which were lit with a light so violet that it was almost black. Earlier in the afternoon, he had espied a chest by the side of the track while riding through this benighted forest. Its top was invitingly open, displaying much gold. But when he'd leapt off his horse to approach it, the chest had sprouted legs and had gone trotting off into the forest, stopping again a few hundred yards away. Now, after several hours of teasing pursuit, he had lost it in these hell-lit tunnels. The unpleasant carvings and occasional disjointed skeletons he passed held no fear for Hrun. They were all in a day's work. He spent a great deal of time in similar situations, seeking gold, or demons, or distressed virgins, and relieving them respectively of their owners, their lives, and at least one cause of their distress. Observe, Hrun, as he leaps cat-footed across a suspicious tunnel mouth. Even in this violet light, his skin gleams coppery. There is much gold about his person, in the form of anklets and wristlets, but otherwise he is naked, except for a leopard-skin loincloth. In his right hand, he carried the magical black sword Kering, which was forged from a thunderbolt and has a soul but suffers no scabbard. Hrun had stolen it only 3 days before from the impregnable palace of the Archmandrite of Bit-Tuni, and he was already regretting it. It was beginning to get on his nerves.
"I tell you, it went down that last passage on the right," hissed Kering, in a voice like the scrape of a blade over stone.
"Be silent!"
"All I said was..."
"Shut up!"
And Two Flower? He was lost. He knew that. Either the building was much bigger than it looked, or he was now on some wide underground level without having gone down any steps, or, as he was beginning to suspect, the inner dimensions of the place disobeyed a fairly basic rule of architecture by being bigger than the outside. And why all these strange lights? They were eight-sided crystals set at regular intervals in the walls and ceiling, and they shed a rather unpleasant glow that didn't so much illuminate as outline the darkness.
"I don't like it,"
said the picture imp from his box around Two Flower's neck. "Why not?" inquired Two Flower.
"It's weird."
"But you're a demon. Demons can't call things weird. I mean, what's weird to a demon?"
"Oh, you know,"
said the demon cautiously.
"Things. Stuff."
Two Flower looked up at the ceiling. "What was that?" he asked. "Didn't you hear something?"
"Me? Hear? No, not a thing,"
the demon insisted. It jerked back into its box and slammed the door. Two Flower tapped on it. The door opened a crack. "It sounded like a stone moving," he explained. The door banged shut. Two Flower shrugged. "Oh, the place is probably falling to..." Two Flower stopped. The reason for this was the bright point of light that had popped into existence a few feet from his eyes. It grew rapidly, and after a few seconds was the tiny bright shape of a man. At this stage, it began to make a noise. Or rather, Two Flower started to hear the noise it had been making all along. It sounded like a sliver of a scream, caught in one long instant of time. The iridescent man was doll-sized now, a tortured shape tumbling in slow motion while hanging in mid-air. It was beginning to look like Rincewind. The wizard's mouth was open, and his face was brilliantly lit by the light of... what? Now, the turning wizard was half man-sized. At that point, the growth was faster. There was a sudden, crowded moment, a rush of air, and an explosion of sound. Rincewind tumbled out of the air, screaming. He hit the floor hard, choked, then rolled over with his head cradled in his arms and his body curled up tightly. When the dust had settled, Two Flower reached out gingerly and tapped the wizard on the shoulder. The human ball rolled up tighter. "It's me," explained Two Flower helpfully. In one movement, Rincewind unrolled and bounced up in front of the little man, his hands gripping his shoulders desperately.
"Don't say it," he hissed.
"Don't say what?"
"The number."
"Number?"
"Yes, number. Between 7 and 9. 4 plus 4.
"What,
8?
Rincewind's hands clapped over the man's mouth.
"Say it and we're doomed. Just don't think about it, right? Trust me."
After the first age of magic, the disposal of grimoires began to become a severe problem on the Discworld. A spell is still a spell, even when imprisoned temporarily in parchment and ink. It has potency. This isn't a problem while the book's owner still lives. But on his death, the spellbook becomes a source of uncontrolled power that cannot easily be defused. In short, spellbooks leak magic. Various solutions have been tried. Countries near the Rim simply loaded down the books of dead mages with leaden pentalfers and threw them over the edge. Near the Hub, less satisfactory alternatives were available. Inserting the offending books in canisters of negatively polarized octyron and sinking them in the fathomless depths of the sea was one. Burial in deep caves on land was earlier ruled out after some districts complained of walking trees and five-headed cats. But before long, the magic seeped out, and eventually fishermen complained of shoals of invisible fish or psychic clams. A temporary solution was the construction in various centres of magical lore of large rooms made of denatured octyron, which is impervious to most forms of magic. Here, the more critical grimoires could be stored until their potency had attenuated. That was how they came to be at Unseen University, the Octavo, greatest of all grimoires, formerly owned by the creator of the universe. It was this book that Rincewind had once opened for a bet. He'd only a second to stare at a page before setting off various alarm spells, but that was time enough for one spell to leap from it and settle in his memory like a toad in a stone. "We're doomed," Rincewind stated. "We've been walking around all night. I tell you, this place is a spider web. It doesn't matter which way we go, we'll end up in the centre. What we've got to do is find this Bel Shamharoth person, and he'll let us out," said Twoflower. Rincewind glared at him in the hellish purple glow. "Find Bel Shamharoth," he said. "Yes, we don't have to get involved. Find the Soul Render and not get involved. Just give him a nod, I suppose, and ask the way to the exit. Explain things to the sender of..." Rincewind bit off the end of the word just in time and finished, "You're insane! Hey, come back!" He darted down the passage after Twoflower, and after a few moments came to a halt with a groan. The violet light was intense here, giving everything new and unpleasant colours. This wasn't a passage. It was a wide room with walls to a number that Rincewind didn't dare to contemplate. Rincewind saw, a little way off, a low altar with the same number of sides as 4 times 2. It didn't occupy the centre of the room, however. The centre was occupied by a huge stone slab with twice as many sides as a square. It looked massive. In the strange light, it appeared to be slightly tilted, with one edge standing proud of the slabs around it. Twoflower was standing on it. "Hey, Rincewind, look what's here!" The luggage came ambling down one of the other passages that radiated from the room. "That's great," said Rincewind. "Fine, it can lead us out of here. Now!" Twoflower was already rummaging in the chest. "Yes," he said, "after I've taken a few pictures, just let me fit the attachment. I said now!" Rincewind stopped. Harun the Barbarian was standing in the passage mouth directly opposite him, a great black sword held in one ham-sized fist.
"You?"
said Harun uncertainly. "Aha, yes," said Rincewind. "Harun, isn't it? Long time no see. What brings you here?" Harun pointed to the luggage.
"That,"
he said. Then he added, in a tone that combined statement, claim, threat, and ultimatum,
"Mine."
"It belongs to Twoflower here," said Rincewind. "Here's a tip. Don't touch it." It dawned on him that this was precisely the wrong thing to say, but Harun had already pushed Twoflower away and was reaching for the luggage, which sprouted legs, backed away, and raised its lid threateningly. In the uncertain light, Rincewind thought he could see rows of enormous teeth, white as bleached beechwood. "Harun," he said quickly, "there's something I ought to tell you."
"What?"
he said. "It's about numbers. Look, you know if you add 7 and 1, or 3 and 5, or take 2 from 10, and you get a number, while you're here, don't say it, and we might all stand a chance of getting out of here alive."
"Who is he?" asked Twoflower.
He was holding a cage in his hands, dredged from the bottommost depths of the luggage. It appeared to be full of sulking pink lizards.
"I am Harun,"
said Harun proudly. Then he looked at Rincewind.
"What?"
he said. "Just don't say it, okay?" said Rincewind. The sword in Harun's hand suddenly spoke in a voice like a claw being scraped across glass.
"Strange! Why can't he say 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8,
said the echoes. And although they became softer, they refused to die away. They bounced from wall to wall, crossing and recrossing, and the violet light flickered in time with the sound.
"You did it!" screamed Rincewind. "I said you shouldn't say 8!
He stopped, appalled at himself. But the word was out now and joined its colleagues in the general susurration. The air suddenly seemed to be thicker than treacle. A charge of magic, bigger than he had ever seen, was building up. When he moved, in painful slow motion, his limbs left trails of golden sparks that traced their shape in the air.
Behind him, there was a rumble as the great octagonal slab rose into the air, exposing the blackness of a pit, hung for a moment on one edge, and crashed down on the floor. Something thin and black snaked out of the pit and wrapped itself around Rincewind's ankle. He screamed as he landed heavily on the vibrating flagstones. The tentacle started to pull him across the floor. There was a noise like a singing saw, and the pressure on Rincewind's legs abruptly ceased. He turned his head and saw Harun, crouched by the pit, his sword a blur as it hacked at the tentacles racing out towards him. Twoflower was feverishly attaching the cage of subdued lizards to the picture box, which he'd mounted on a tripod.
"I've just got to get a picture of this," he muttered. "It's stupendous. Can you hear me, imp?"
The picture imp opened his tiny hatch, glanced momentarily at the scene around the pit, and vanished into the box. Rincewind jumped up as something touched his leg and brought his heel down on a questing tentacle.
"Come on," he said. "Hey," Twoflower said, "it's got my luggage."
Before Rincewind could restrain him, Twoflower ran around the edge of the pit to the box, which was being dragged across the floor while its lid snapped ineffectually at the tentacle that held it. Harun himself was already an indistinct shape amid the tightening coils. Even as Rincewind stared in horror, the hero's sword was wrenched from his grasp and hurled against a wall. Rincewind didn't move. He was looking at the thing rising out of the pit. It was an enormous eye, and it was staring directly at him. He whimpered as a tentacle fastened itself around his waist. The words of the spell rose unbidden in his throat. He opened his mouth as in a dream. Another tentacle shot out like a whip and coiled around his throat, choking him. Staggering and gasping, Rincewind was dragged across the floor. One flailing arm caught Twoflower's picture box as it skittered past on its tripod. He snatched it up instinctively. If only he could get enough room to swing it against the eye. In front of him, the lizards stirred in their cages on the picture box. Rincewind saw that they had overlarge tails that were bluish-white and, he realized, throbbing alarmingly. As he was drawn towards the eye, the terror-struck Rincewind raised the box protectively and at the same time heard the picture imp say,
"They're about ripe now. Can't hold them any longer. Everyone smile, please."
There was a flash of light so white and so bright. It didn't seem like light at all. Bel-Sham-Haroth screamed. The tentacles, hurling their various cargoes around the room, bunched up protectively in front of the abused eye. The whole mass dropped into the pit, and a moment later, the big slab was snatched up and slammed into place, leaving a number of thrashing limbs trapped around the edge. Twoflower was in a crumpled heap against the wall. But at least he was groaning. The wizard pulled himself across the floor painfully and whispered, "What the hell was that?"
"Why were they so bright?" muttered Twoflower. "God, my head!"
"Too bright," said Rincewind. He looked across the floor to the cage on the picture box. The lizards inside, now noticeably thinner, were watching him with interest.
"The salamanders," moaned Twoflower. "The picture will be overexposed, I know it."
"Salamanders?"
"Of course. Standard attachment."
Rincewind tried to remember the little he knew about them. They were magical creatures. They also had no mouths, since they subsisted entirely on the nourishing quality of the octarine wavelength in the Discworld sunlight, which they absorbed through their skins. Rincewind nodded grimly. With all the octarine light in this magical place, the creatures had been gorging themselves, and then nature had taken its course. He looked around at a sudden grinding noise, and a voice like a carving knife cutting through silk said,
"This is very undignified."
"Shut up," said Harun.
He was using Kering to lever the top off the altar. He looked up at Rincewind and grinned.
"Mighty magic," commented the barbarian,
pushing down heavily on the complaining sword with a hand the size of a ham.
Now we share the treasure, eh?
How do you know there's treasure in there? Rincewind said. Hurun heaved and managed to hook his fingers under the stone. He gritted his teeth. The stone swung up and landed heavily on the floor. Something struck Rincewind's hand heavily. It was a piece of stone with 5+3 sides. He looked up at the ceiling. Should it be sagging like that? Harun hummed a little tune as he began to pull crumbling leather from the desecrated altar. The air crackled, fluoresced, hummed. Intangible winds gripped the wizard's robe, flapping it out in eddies of blue and green sparks. Around Rincewind's head, mad, half-formed spirits howled and gibbered as they were sucked past. Twoflower staggered up, bent double in the teeth of the astral gale. "What the hell is this?" he shouted. Rincewind half-turned. Immediately the howling wind caught him, nearly pitching him over. Poltergeist eddies spinning in the rushing air snatched at his feet. Harun's arms shot out and caught him. A moment later, he and Twoflower had been dragged into the lee of the ravaged altar and lay panting on the floor. "We're doomed," murmured Rincewind, while overhead the roof cracked and shifted. Harun glanced up at the widening cracks in the ceiling and sighed. Then he put two fingers in his mouth and whistled. His war horse cantered through a creaking archway and reared up by its master, its mane streaming in the gale. The barbarian pulled himself to his feet and slung his treasure bags into a sack that hung from the saddle, then hauled himself onto the beast's back. He reached down and grabbed Twoflower by the scruff of his neck, dragging him across the saddle tree. As the horse turned around, Rincewind took a desperate leap and landed behind Harun, who raised no objection. The horse pounded sure-footed along the tunnels, leaping sudden slides of rubble and adroitly side-stepping huge stones as they thundered down from the straining roof. Rincewind, clinging on grimly, looked behind. Close behind, speeding through the flickering violet light, were a large, ominous-looking chest and a picture box that skittered along dangerously on its three legs. They reached the outer air a moment before the octagonal arch finally broke and smashed into the flags. Behind them, a column of dust rose as the temple collapsed in on itself. But they didn't look back. Twoflower was helping the heroes sort through the treasure stolen from the temple. Rincewind was trying to shut his ears to the grating voice behind him. It was no use.
"And then I belonged to the Pasha of Redurat and played a prominent part in the Battle of the Great Neth, which is where I received the slight nick you may have noticed, some 2/3 of the way up my blade,"
Kering was saying from its temporary home in a tussock.
"Am I boring you?"
"Hm? Oh, no, no, not at all. It's all very interesting," said Rincewind, with his eyes still on Harun. How trustworthy would he be? Here they were, out in the wilds. There were trolls about. Twoflower hurried over to the wizard. "I had a great idea," he burbled. "Yeah," said Rincewind wearily. "Why don't we get Harun to accompany us?" Twoflower looked amazed.
"How did you know?" he said.
Harun ceased stuffing silverware into his saddlebags and grinned encouragingly at them. Then his eyes strayed back to the luggage.
"If we had him with us, who'd attack us?" said Twoflower.
Rincewind scratched his chin. "Harun?" he suggested.
"But we saved his life in the temple."
"Well, if by attack you mean kill," said Rincewind, "I don't think he'd do that. He's not that sort. He'd just rob us and tie us up and leave us for the wolves, I expect."
"Oh, come on! Look, this is real life," snapped Rincewind.
Then the answer hit him. He looked from Harun to the picture box. "I've got an idea," he said. "I mean, what is it heroes really want?"
"Gold?"
said Twoflower. "No, I mean really want." "I don't quite understand." Rincewind picked up the picture box. "Harun," he said, "come over here, will you?" The days passed peacefully. True, a small band of bridge trolls tried to ambush them on one occasion, and a party of brigands nearly caught them unawares one night, but unwisely tried to investigate the luggage before slaughtering the sleepers. Harun demanded and got double pay for both occasions. "If any harm comes to us," said Rincewind, "then there will be no one to operate the magic box. No more pictures of Harun. You understand?" Harun nodded, his eyes fixed on the latest picture. It showed Harun striking a heroic pose with one foot on a heap of slain trolls.
"Me and you and little friend Two Flowers, we all get on okay," he said. "Also, tomorrow maybe we get a better profile. Okay?"
He carefully wrapped the picture in troll skin and stowed it in his saddlebag along with the others. "You win," said Fate, pushing the heap of souls across the gaming table. The assembled gods relaxed. "There will be other games," he added. The lady smiled into two eyes that were like holes in the universe. The Lure of the Wyrm. It was called the Wyrmberg, and it rose almost one half of a mile above the Green Valley, a mountain huge, grey, and upside down. At its base, it was a mere score of yards across. Then it rose through clinging cloud, curving gracefully outward like an upturned trumpet, until it was truncated by a plateau fully a quarter of a mile across. There was a tiny forest up there, its greenery cascading over the lip. There were buildings. There was even a small river, tumbling over the edge in a waterfall so wind-whipped that it reached the ground as rain. There were also a number of cave mouths a few yards below the plateau. They had a crudely carved, regular look about them, so that on this crisp autumn morning, the Wyrmberg hung over the clouds like a giant's dovecot. This would mean that the doves had a wingspan slightly in excess of 40 yards. "I knew it," said Rincewind. "We're in a strong magical field." Two Flower and Harun looked around the little hollow where they'd made their noonday halt. Harun shrugged and went back to oiling his biceps.
"Looks all right to me," he said.
"Try tossing a coin," said Rincewind. Harun reached into his pouch and withdrew a Zishalotti leaden quarter iotum and balanced it on a purple thumbnail.
"You call," he said. "Heads or..."
He inspected the obverse with an air of intense concentration.
"Some sort of fish with legs."
Harun grinned and flicked his thumb. The iotum rose, spinning. "Edge," said Rincewind.
"Oh, edge it is," said Harun. "So what?"
"Try it again," Rincewind suggested. Harun pulled out a fistful of coins. The first two landed in the usual manner. So did the fourth. The third landed on its edge and balanced there. The fifth turned into a small yellow caterpillar and crawled away. The sixth, upon reaching its zenith, vanished with a sharp spang. Rincewind sighed. He'd been dreading this. "We've strayed into a zone with a high magical index," he said. "Don't ask me how. Once upon a time, a really powerful magic field must have been generated here, and we're feeling the after effects."
"Precisely," said a passing bush.
"Let's get out of here," said Harun.
"What are they doing now?"
asked the old man. The young woman glanced at the scrying glass. "Heading rimwards at speed," she reported. "By the way, they've still got that box on legs." The old man chuckled.
"Sapient pearwood," he said. "Remarkable. Yes, I think we'll have that. Please see to it, my dear, before they go beyond your power, perhaps."
Silence, or, "Ah, what a liaison," said the old man. In this dim light, there was something odd about the way he was slumped in the stone chair.
"You killed me once already, remember?"
She stood up, tossing back her hair scornfully. It was red, flecked with gold. Erect, Eliezer Wyrmbidder was entirely a magnificent sight. She was also almost naked, except for a couple of mere scraps of the lightest chainmail and riding boots of iridescent dragonhide. Eliezer snorted and strode out of the hall. Her father didn't bother to watch her go. As a wizard, even a dead wizard, his optic nerves had long since become attuned to seeing into levels and dimensions far removed from common reality, and were therefore somewhat inefficient at observing the merely mundane. Besides, since he was now suspended in the narrow space between the living world and the dark shadow world of death, he could survey the whole of causality itself. Eliezer strode down the worn steps that led into the hollow heart of the Wirrenberg, followed by half a dozen riders. Would this be the opportunity? Perhaps here was the key to break the deadlock, the key to the throne of the Wirrenberg. It was rightfully hers, of course, but tradition said that only a man could rule the Wirrenberg. That irked Eliezer. And when she was angry, the power flowed stronger, and the dragons were especially big and ugly. If she had a man, things would be different. Someone who, for preference, was a big, strapping lad, but short on brains. Someone who would do what he was told. The biggest of the three now fleeing the Dragonlands might do. And if it turned out that he wouldn't, well, dragons were always hungry. The stairway passed through a stone arch and ended in a narrow ledge near the roof of the great cavern where the Wyrms roosted. Sunbeams from the myriad entrances around the walls crisscrossed the dusty gloom like amber rods. Below, they revealed nothing but a thin haze. Above. The walking rings started so close to Eliezer's head that she could reach up and touch one. They stretched away in their thousands across the upturned acres of the cavern roof. Yet they were as nothing compared to the 88 major rings that clustered near the apex of the dome. From them, the dragons sense Eliezer's presence. Air swishes around the cavern as 88 pairs of wings unfold like a complicated puzzle. Great heads with multifaceted eyes peer down at her. The beasts are still faintly transparent. While the men around her take their hook boots from the rack, Eliezer bends her mind to the task of full visualization. Above her in the musty air, the dragons become fully visible, bronze scales dully reflecting the sunbeam shafts. Now she too buckles on the hook boots and turns a graceful cartwheel to bring their hooks with a faint clang against a couple of the walking rings in the ceiling. Only now it is the floor. The world has changed. Now she is standing on the edge of a deep bowl or crater floored with the little rings, across which the dragon riders are already strolling with a pendulum gait. In the centre of the bowl, their huge mounts wait among the herd. Far above are the distant rocks of the cavern floor, discoloured by centuries of dragon droppings. Eliezer sets off towards her own dragon, Aleolith, who turns his great head towards her. She swings down the mounting ladder and lands with her legs locked around Aleolith's leathery neck. The dragon spreads his wings and drops.
"They're gaining!" screamed Rincewind.
He bent even lower over his horse's neck. Twoflower was trying to keep up, while at the same time craning to look at the flying beasts.
"All my life I've wanted to see dragons!" he cried.
"From the inside!" shouted Rincewind.
"Shut up and ride!"
Rincewind whipped his horse and stared at the wood ahead, trying to drag it closer by sheer willpower. He heard the clap of wings before shadows folded around him. He felt the white-hot stab of pain as something sharp scored a line across his shoulders. Behind him, Harun screamed. The barbarian had vaulted down into the heather and had drawn the black sword, Kering.
"No bloody lizard does that to me," he roared.
Rincewind reached the shelter of the trees, where a low branch promptly knocked him out of the saddle. When he awoke, a dragon was hanging from a branch of a large oak tree several hundred feet away. Its bronze-gold wings were tightly wrapped around its body, but the long equine head turned this way and that at the end of a remarkably prehensile neck. It was scanning the forest. It was also semi-transparent, Although the sun glinted off its scales, Rincewind could clearly make out the outlines of the branches behind it. On one of them, a man was sitting. He appeared to be naked, except for a pair of high boots, a leather hold-all in the region of his groin, and a high-crested helmet. Rincewind wriggled sideways until foliage masked the oak and its occupants. Then he scrambled to his feet and headed off between the trees. When he'd put about a mile between him and the dragon, he stopped and collapsed against a tree, which then spoke to him. "Psst," it said. Dreading what he might see, Rincewind let his gaze slide upwards. It fixed on a black sword thrust straight through the branch above Rincewind's head.
"Don't just stand there," said the sword. "Pull me out."
"What?" said Rincewind.
"Pull me out," repeated Kering.
"What happened to the others?" said Rincewind.
"Oh, the dragons got them, and the horses, and that box thing. Me too, except that Hrun dropped me. What a stroke of luck for you. I expect you'll be in a hurry to rescue them," it added.
"Yes, well..."
"So, if you'll just pull me out, we can be off."
Rincewind scrambled up the tree and inched along the branch. Kering was buried very firmly in the wood. He gripped the pommel and heaved until the blade slid free. Back on the ground, he decided to break the news. "I really don't think rescue's a good idea," he said. "I think we'd better head back to a city, you know, to raise a search party."
"The dragons headed hubwards," said Kering. "However, I suggest we start with the one in the trees over there."
"Sorry, but..."
"If you don't stop arguing, I'll chop your head off."
Rincewind saw his own arm snap up until the shimmering blade was humming a mere inch from his throat. He tried to force his fingers to let go. They wouldn't. Bronze Persepha rumbled deep in his throat. Cassandra, the dragon rider, leant forward and squinted across the clearing.
"I see him," he said.
He swung himself down easily from branch to branch and landed lightly on the tussocky grass, drawing his sword. The approaching man was armed, but the dragon rider observed with some interest the strange way in which he held the sword in front of him at arm's length, as though embarrassed to be seen in its company. Later, Cassandra remembered only two things about the fight. He recalled the uncanny way in which the wizard's sword curved up and caught his own blade with a shock that jerked it out of his grip. The other thing, and it was this, he averred, that led to his downfall, was that the wizard was covering his eyes with one hand. Cassandra jumped back to avoid another thrust and fell full length on the turf. With a snarl, Persepha unfolded his great wings and launched himself from his tree. A moment later, the wizard was standing over Cassandra, shouting, "Tell it that if it singes me, I'll let the sword go." The tip of the black sword was hovering over Cassandra's throat. "Persepha!" Cassandra shouted. The dragon pulled out of the dive that would have removed Rincewind's head and flapped ponderously back to the tree.
"Talk!"
screamed Rincewind.
"What would you like me to say?"
"Where are my friends?"
"I expect they've been taken back to the Wirrenberg."
"Right then," said Rincewind as diffidently as he could manage. "You'd better take me to this Wirrenberg of yours, hadn't you?"
"Oh, all right," said Cassandra sulkily.
He wriggled out from under the sword and waved at the dragon, which took wing again and glided in towards them. Rincewind looked at the dragon. He could quite clearly see through it to the crushed grass on which it lay, but when he gingerly touched a scale that was a mere golden sheen on thin air, it felt solid enough. "I didn't know dragons could be seen through," he said. Cassandra shrugged. "Didn't you?" he said. He swung himself astride the dragon awkwardly, because Rincewind was hanging onto his belt. Once uncomfortably aboard, the wizard moved his white knuckle grip to a convenient piece of harness and prodded Cassandra lightly with the sword. Persepha clawed its way into the air with a series of vertebrae-shattering bounds. At the top of its last leap, The wide wings unfolded with a snap and spread out with a thump which shook the trees. Then the ground was gone, dropping away in a series of gentle jerks. Sapphire was suddenly rising gracefully, the afternoon sunlight gleaming off wings that were still no more than a golden film. Rincewind made the mistake of glancing downwards, and found himself looking through the dragon to the treetops below. Far below. His stomach shrank at the sight. Cassandra half-turned and shouted in his ear, "Behold! The Wirrumburg!" Rincewind saw the impossibly inverted mountain rearing out of the deep forested valley like a trumpet in a tub of moss. Even at this distance, he could make out the faint octarine glow in the air that must be indicating a stable magic aura of at least, he gasped, several milliprime, at least. "Oh, no," he said. He averted his eyes quickly and realized that he could now no longer see the ground through the dragon. As they glided around in a wide circle towards the Wirrumburg, it was definitely taking on a more solid form, as if the creature's body was filling with a gold mist. By the time the Wirrumburg was in front of them, the dragon was as real as a rock. The flared plateau of the upturned mountain drifted towards them. The dragon didn't even slow. Rincewind saw a cave mouth. Persephone skimmed towards it. There was a brief vision of rock flashing past, blurred by speed. Then the dragon was inside a cave, but bigger than any cave had a right to be. There were other dragons, gold, silver, black, white, flapping across the sun-shafted air. High in the domed roof of the cavern, scores of others hung from huge rings, their wings wrapped bat-like around their bodies. There were men up there, too. Rincewind swallowed hard when he saw them, because they were walking on that broad expanse of ceiling like flies. Then he made out the thousands of tiny rings that studded the ceiling. A number of inverted men were watching Persephone's flight with interest. Rincewind swallowed again. "Well," he asked in a whisper, "any suggestions?"
"Obviously, you attack," said Kering scornfully.
"Why didn't I think of that?" said Rincewind. "Could it be because they all have crossbows?" Before Kering could reply, Persephone reared in midair and alighted on one of the large rings, which rocked alarmingly. Men were converging on the ring from all directions, walking with a swaying motion as their hooked boots engaged the ceiling rings. There were more boots on a rack that hung in a small platform built on the side of the perch ring. Before Rincewind could stop him, the dragon rider had leapt from the creature's back to land on the platform, where he stood grinning at the wizard's discomfiture. There was a small expressive sound made by a number of crossbows being cocked.
"Surrender," said Cassandra.
Rincewind opened his mouth to do so. Kering hummed a warning, and agonizing waves of pain shot up his arm.
"Never!"
he squeaked. The pain stopped.
"Of course he won't," boomed an expansive voice behind him. "He's a hero, isn't he?"
Rincewind turned and looked into a pair of hairy nostrils. They belonged to a heavily built young man, hanging nonchalantly from the ceiling by his boots.
"What is your name, hero?" said the man. Agony shot up Rincewind's arm. "Ah! Ah! I'm Rincewind of Ankh!" he managed to gasp.
"And I am Leoct Dragonlord," said the hanging man.
"You have come to challenge me in mortal combat."
"Well, no, I didn't.
Cassandra, help our hero into a pair of hook boots. I'm sure he's anxious to get started."
"No, look, I just came here to find my friends. I'm sure there's no..." Rincewind began, as the dragon rider guided him firmly onto the platform, pushed him onto a seat, and proceeded to strap hook boots to his feet.
"You will see your friends soon enough," said Dragonlord airily. "Show him how to reach the rings, Cassandra."
"Look what you've got me into," Rincewind hissed.
Kering vibrated in his hand.
"Remember that I am a magic sword," it hummed.
"Climb the ladder and grab a ring," said the dragon rider. "Then bring your feet up until the hooks catch."
He helped the protesting wizard climb until he was hanging upside down, robe tucked into his breeches, kering dangling from one hand. A dragon rider handed Leo a long shape wrapped in red silk.
"We fight to the death," he said.
"And I suppose I earn my freedom if I win?" said Rincewind.
"Don't be naive."
Rincewind took a deep breath. "I suppose I should warn you that this is a magic sword." Leo let the red silk wrapping drop away into the gloom and flourished a jet-black blade.
"What a coincidence," he said,
and lunged. Rincewind went rigid with fright, but his arm swung out as Kering shot forward. The swords met in an explosion of octarine light. Leo swung himself backwards, his eyes narrowing. Kering leapt past his guard, and although the Dragon Lord's sword jerked up to deflect most of the force, the result was a thin red line across its master's torso. With a growl, he launched himself at the wizard, boots clattering as he slid from ring to ring. The swords met again in another violent discharge of magic, and at the same time, Leo brought his other hand down against Rincewind's head, jarring him so hard that one foot jerked out of its ring. A grinning Leo swung back and brought his sword around in a lazy arc. Rincewind ducked. The blade hissed coldly through the air beside his head and entered the rock of the cavern roof without slowing. With that desperation only available to the really terrified, Rincewind uncoiled like a snake and launched himself across the space between them. He locked both hands around the Dragon Lord's sword arm and wrenched. It was at that moment that Rincewind's one remaining ring, already overburdened, slid out of the rock. He plunged down, swung wildly, and ended up dangling with his hands gripping the Dragon Lord's arm. "Let go, damn you!" Leo screamed. "Or we'll both die!" Rincewind said nothing. "Shoot him!" bellowed Leo. Out of the corner of his eye, Rincewind saw several crossbows levelled at him. Leo chose that moment to flail down with his free hand, and a fistful of rings stabbed into the wizard's fingers. He let go. Twoflower grabbed the bars and pulled himself up.
"See anything?" said Hurun.
"Just clouds."
Hurun lifted him down again and sat on the edge of one of the wooden beds.
"Bloody hell," he said.
"Don't despair," said Twoflower. "I expect it's all some sort of misunderstanding. I expect they'll release us soon, and when we get back, we can say we've seen dragons. What about that, eh?"
"Dragons don't exist," said Hurun flatly. "I don't know what we're seeing, but they aren't dragons."
"But they carried us up in the air. In that hall there must have been hundreds."
"I expect it was just magic," said Hurun dismissively.
"Well, they look like dragons," said Twoflower, an air of defiance about him. "I always wanted to see dragons ever since I was a little lad. Dragons flying around in the sky, breathing flames."
But there was something wrong with these dragons. They were too small and sleek compared to the ones in his mind's eye. Dragons ought to be big and green and clawed and exotic and fire-breathing. Big and green, with long, sharp...
"Hurun," he said.
There was a snore from the other bunk. At that moment, the door was flung back. Half a dozen guards hurtled through it, crossbows at the ready. A woman strode into the room. Not many women can stride convincingly, but she managed it. She glanced briefly at Twoflower, as one might look at a piece of furniture, then glared down at the man on the bed. She drew a slim black dagger from her belt and stabbed downward. Before it was halfway through its arc, Hurun's right hand moved so fast that it appeared to travel between two points in space without at any time occupying the intervening air. It closed around the woman's wrist with a dull smack. His other hand groped feverishly for a sword that wasn't there. Hurun awoke. he said, looking up at the woman with a puzzled frown. Then he caught sight of the bowman.
"Let go," said the woman.
Hurun released his grip slowly. She stepped back, massaging her wrist.
"So," she said at last, You pass the first test. What is your name, barbarian?
I am Hrun of Chimeria. And you?
Eliezer Dragon Lady.
You are the lord of this place?
That remains to be seen. You have the look about you of a hired sword, Hrun of Chimeria. I could use you, if you pass the tests, of course. There are three of them. You have passed the first.
What are the other...
Hrun paused. His lips moved soundlessly, and then he hazarded,
Two.
Perilous.
Excuse me, said Twoflower.
And if I fail these tests, said Hrun.
If you had failed the first test, you would now be dead. This may be considered a typical penalty.
Look,
began Twoflower. Eliezer spared him a brief glance. Take that away, she said.
Two of the guards shouldered their bows, grasped Twoflower by the elbows, and lifted him off the ground. Then they trotted smartly through the doorway. They hurried down the corridor, stopped in front of another door, and dragged it open. Twoflower landed in a heap of what might once have been straw. The door banged shut, its echoes punctuated by the sound of bolts being slammed home. In the other cell, Hrun had barely blinked.
Okay,
he said.
What is the second test?
You must kill my two brothers.
Good fighters, are they?
Renowned.
So, in return for all this...
You will wed me and become Lord of the Wyrmberg.
Twoflower sat on his straw and stared into the darkness. He wondered how long he'd been there, hours at least. He tried to think of something else. Grass, trees, fresh air, dragons.
Dragons. There was the faintest of scrabblings in the darkness. Twoflower fervently found himself wishing for a light. A gout of flame rolled past his head and struck the far wall. As the rocks flashed into furnace heat, he looked up at the dragon that now occupied more than half the cell.
I obey, Lord,
said a voice in his head.
By the glow of the crackling, spitting stone, Twoflower looked into his own reflection in two enormous green eyes. Beyond them, the dragon was as multi-hued, horned, spiked, and lithe as the one in his memory. A real dragon. Its folded wings were wide enough to scrape the wall on both sides of the room. It lay with him between its talons.
Obey, he said.
Of course, Lord.
The glow faded away.
Twoflower pointed a trembling finger at where he remembered the door to be and said,
Open it. The dragon raised its huge head. Again the ball of flame rolled out. The door fell in two pieces in the passage beyond. The flame winked out with a suddenness that was almost as startling as its arrival. Twoflower stepped gingerly over the cooling door and looked up and down the corridor. It was empty. The dragon followed. The heavy door frame caused it some minor difficulty, which it overcame with a swing of its shoulders.
How did you get there? Said Twoflower. You summoned me, master.
Well, I don't remember doing that.
In your mind, you called me up. In your mind,
thought the dragon patiently.
You mean, I just thought of you and there you were?
Yes.
It was magic?
Yes.
But I've thought about dragons all my life.
In this place, the frontier between thought and reality is probably a little confused. All I know is that once I was not, and then you thought of me, and then I was. Therefore, of course, I am yours to command.
Good grief! Can you fly?
Of course.
What is your name, dragon?
Said Twoflower.
I don't know.
I think I shall call you Nine Reeds.
That is my name, then.
They waded through the all-encroaching dust in a series of huge, dark-pillared halls which had been carved out of the solid rock. Then Twoflower saw the path,
leading away into yet another dark tunnel mouth. Someone had been using it regularly and recently. It was a deep, narrow trail in the grey blanket. Two-Flower followed it. It led through still more lofty halls and ended at a pair of green bronze doors. In front of Two-Flower, at chest height, was a small handle shaped like a brass dragon. When he touched it, the doors swung open.